The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight the topic is conditionality, and this will begin a multi-week topic discussion on the topic. Tonight, just looking at the topic in general, conditionality in general. And probably next week we'll begin to look at one of the key teachings on conditionality, that of dependent origination, which is the Buddha's description of the conditions that come together in our minds to lead us into stress and suffering. It's a foundational teaching for us in terms of understanding how suffering is created. But today I just really like to explore conditionality in general, you know, what it is, and a little bit about the importance of this teaching in the Buddhist tradition. One thing I think that is a key part of the understanding of conditionality in the Buddhist teaching is that experience is not random. There are lawful processes happening in our bodies and our minds that lead to what's arising in this moment. What's arising in this moment is a product of a whole host of conditions from the past, causes and conditions from the past, as well as what's happening now, how we are in relationship to it in the present moment. And so the conditioning that that happens is, it's not just about past conditioning now. It's about also about kind of the present moment, how the present moment conditions itself. So a co-conditioning, a co-arising of experience, how our minds are in relationship to experience will affect how the experience is felt. There's a general framing that the Buddha offered in terms of describing the general teaching of conditionality. He said, when this is, that is. When this arises, that arises. And so that's speaking to the kind of the two ways of the past conditioning now. When this arises, that arises, you know, the kind of the something arises and then something arises in dependence on that. And that's often how we think of conditionality. Something happens and then something follows. But he also says, when this is, that is, kind of the co-arising or the two things happening together. And so, you know, that might be understood or seen in, for instance, a mind state. So if there's a mind state that's present already, you know, so some frustration is present, then when something arises in experience, or maybe anger is present or something like that. So there's the mind state that's present, and then something arises. We may then tend to the experience of that new arising is going to be conditioned or going to be shaped by, conditioned by that mind state that's already there. And so, you know, the kind of the arising of generally when we are experiencing something like anger, many of our experiences have an unpleasant quality to them. And so we could say that unpleasantness co-arises with anger, you know, that the anger is kind of creating the conditions that where whatever arises with it is, it may have that unpleasant quality. That's just the example that comes to my mind right now, of how that co-arising works, that conditioning in the present moment. So very similar experiences can happen. Like we might, the same kind of thing can happen, but if we have an attitude of the mind of ease or calm or ease or peace, then our experience of that thing happening is going to be very different than if we have an attitude of aversion or greed in our minds. So the quality in our mind or what's arising in our minds will tend to shape whatever is being known or being received. And so the Buddha describes this, you know, when this is, that is, when this arises, that arises. And then he also talks about conditionality in terms of what's not arising. When this isn't, that isn't. When this ceases, that ceases. And so this conditionality is primarily in the Buddhist teachings talking about when it's speaking to the arising of conditions that shape suffering. And so when greed arises, for instance, when aversion arises, this tends to shape suffering. So that's a very simple kind of conditionality the Buddha points to. This is most directly pointed to in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth, suffering, there is suffering. Suffering happens. And the second noble truth, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. Now that is my understanding, that is a co-arising there. Sometimes it's said craving is the cause of suffering. That makes it sound like craving happens and then suffering follows. But in my own exploration of the experience, when I look at craving, when I experience craving, when I notice the arising of craving, suffering is already there. It's like you don't have to wait to feel the suffering. It's already there. Often we don't notice it because we are like jumping ahead or thinking about what we want. And so we may not notice the suffering that's there in the craving. But as soon as you start looking at it, as soon as you start observing your experience and noticing what is the experience of craving, you notice that suffering is already there. So that's right there. That is a co-arising. When craving arises, suffering arises. And there's also a whole host of other kinds of sufferings that follow from that. So there are conditions that shape struggle, stress, suffering. And the key one the Buddha pointed to in the Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths, is craving shapes suffering. Craving leads to suffering. And the teaching I mentioned a few minutes ago, the teaching of dependent origination, we could say that that's a detailed unpacking of that second noble truth. It's a detailed description of the processes by which craving leads to suffering and a whole chain, a whole cycle of events that is in play there. So that's one side of things. And then there's also in the third noble truth, the understanding there, the third noble truth is sometimes described as the freedom or the release, the possibility of freedom. The deeper explanation of it is with the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. And so that's the, when this isn't, that isn't. So there's the side of what is it that shapes, that leads towards suffering? And when what isn't present, will suffering not arise? Those are the two key types of conditions that are held in the second and third noble truths. With the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. With the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. How do we end craving? How does craving come to an end? The Four Noble Truths offer the teaching of the Eightfold Path, the fourth noble truth. The Buddha says the Eightfold Path should be developed. And so this is essentially developing a set of conditions that are supportive for the mind to start to understand how to let go of craving. So that's another part of conditionality. In a way, the fourth noble truth, the shaping of those wholesome qualities, is what allows the mind to begin to understand suffering, that first noble truth, and release the craving that is shaping that suffering. So there are there's also the possibility of the conditionality shaping something wholesome that leads to the ending of suffering. So often that third noble truth talks about when craving, you know, with the ending of craving is the ending of suffering, making it seem like that's all that we have to look for, or that's all that we have to do is somehow have craving come to an end. But then the Buddha points out that, you know, that's not so easy. We need to look at what are the conditions that support the mind to be able to let go of suffering. And so that's the cultivation of wholesome qualities. So cultivating wholesome qualities is a condition that supports the letting go of craving. So there are conditions that shape suffering. There are conditions that will support the mind heading towards freedom from suffering. This teaching is kind of encapsulated in a way in the teaching of karma, which maybe we'll get to in a few weeks also, because that's another key teaching in the Buddha's teachings around how conditionality works in our lives. And that one really begins to point out or talk about what kinds of things. So not just craving, you know, so the Four Noble Truths point to craving is kind of like, that's where the arising of suffering is. The teaching on karma is a little bit broader. It points out that unwholesome qualities, unskillful qualities, basically qualities rooted in greed, aversion, delusion, those mind states, when actions arise out of those mind states, it tends to shape suffering. And then the other side of karma is that when actions arise out of the absence of those mind states, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, and the flip side of those, you know, that it's interesting, what's non-greed? It's the opposite of greed would be giving. Instead of taking, giving. The opposite of aversion, of hatred, would be love. The opposite of confusion, delusion, would be wisdom. And so things, motive, actions, choices motivated out of generosity, love, and wisdom, that tends to lead us in the direction of less suffering. And again, you know, those are shaped by the qualities of love, of compassion, of wisdom, of generosity, tend to be shaped by the wholesome tools, the wholesome qualities that are found in the Eightfold Path. Behaving ethically, understanding how suffering happens in our lives. The whole beginning of the Eightfold Path is right view, and the understanding of how suffering kind of works intellectually, not so much experientially at the beginning, but more hearing about how it works can help us to orient towards maybe there's another way to be in this world that shapes our choices, shapes our intentions. hearing about the possibility of a different way to live shapes different intentions for how to live. And then choices around ethical conduct, and then bringing in mindfulness and wise effort, concentration, all of these support us to cultivate those wholesome qualities, to recognize, and what the mindfulness also does. So another conditioning, beautiful aspect of the conditioning of the practice. I mean, the entirety of our lives is conditioned. There's nothing that's outside of, in our experience, that's outside of conditioning. The conditions of our lives of the past have shaped how we are in this moment. And our choices now are shaped also. That may make it sound like there's not a possibility. It's interesting, this, the way it sounds when you talk about it, it sounds deterministic. If everything is conditioned and this moment is conditioned, the choices in this moment are conditioned, then how is it not deterministic? And some of the understanding, one teacher, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, points out that it's not deterministic because of that very, it's not deterministic means past determines future. What happened in the past is going to determine what happens in the future. But the conditioning works that what's happening in this present moment can change, can shape how we are with it right now. And so the condition of hearing the teachings of the Dharma, that's a condition that shapes choices, that shapes, you know, if you hear the Dharma at a time in your life when you're open and receptive and curious about what might be a way to alleviate the suffering of my life, then the mind might in that moment turn towards engaging with it, which would be the intention right there. And so the condition of hearing the Dharma is itself a condition that shapes our experience. And then maybe we start to practice, maybe we start to cultivate mindfulness, get curious about looking at our minds. And what does that do for us? You know, it begins to educate our minds about what is happening in there. You know, before I met the practice, you know, I like had no clue about that, like what I talked about earlier, the experience of craving being suffering, the experience of anger being suffering. You know, I thought that anger was going to make the other person miserable. As soon as I started paying attention to anger, it's like, wow, that's not, you know, maybe it does make the other person miserable, but boy, it's making me miserable first. So this is how mindfulness works. It begins to inform our system about what is suffering and begins to inform our system that those qualities based on greed, aversion, delusion, that they are suffering in the moment, that they create stress in the moment. They are not well-being in the moment. And because of the way our system is kind of oriented or aimed, you know, another aspect of our humanness is that this system wants to move in the direction of well-being, another kind of conditioning. The natural movement of our human experience is to want to move in the direction of well-being. And our confusion, our delusion about how we get to well-being has gotten in the way of seeing what well-being actually is. Before I actually turned and looked at anger, I thought anger was actually helping me. Thought it was doing something good for me. So the paying attention with mindfulness begins to help the mind sort apart these two, what's helpful, what's not helpful, in terms of moving towards well-being, in terms of moving away from stress and suffering. And that's just conditioning. When we start being mindful, the natural processes of conditioning will lead us to let go of, begin to let go of those things that take us away from well-being. So conditioning works for us when wise mindfulness is present. You know, conditioning is shaping, beginning to help to shape when wise mindfulness is present. And we're observing what's happening with that kind of curiosity. What is this experience anyway? Not to try to get rid of it or fix it or change it, but to understand it. Then what will naturally happen is the conditioned process of releasing suffering over time. It's not an immediate thing, but it is a natural process. And the natural process of conditioning without mindfulness, you know, without when we're not really attending to things, is that our minds tend to be pretty short-sighted. You know, they go for the quickest hit of feeling good. And often that is trying to get what I want or get rid of what I don't want, motivated by greed, motivated by aversion. So there is a natural, also very human shaping of greed, aversion, and delusion. And that tends to be what we have inherited in our lives. Not only our own shaping of this, but the shaping of our culture, our families, our, you know, our countries, everything that's happened in our history, all the way back. You know, Buddha says that conditioned pattern, the conditions that led to what's happening right now, is so vast that if you try to figure it all out, you'll go mad. You know, it's just like there's so many conditions that come into what's happening in this moment. And so he points to really looking at that. The key that he points to is, what is your relationship right in this moment to what's happening in this moment? That's the key conditioning that will either shape the movement towards letting go of suffering or continuing to hold on to it. And so if what's in our mind in the present moment is, I got to get that thing, that's what's going to make me happy, that's what we're going to be shaping, that's what's going to be conditioned. If instead of that, the mindfulness arises, wise mindfulness arises to see, wow, the mind is really caught by craving right now. Craving is unpleasant. This is what it feels like to be a human being that's craving. It's going to shape a completely different direction. Notice that the craving doesn't have to vanish for the shaping to move in a wholesome direction, for the conditioning to unfold in a wholesome direction. It doesn't have to vanish instantly. The shift is from believing the craving, believing that mind state is like, that's following that mind state is what's going to make me happy, versus curiosity about the experience of the mind state and recognizing how is it experienced. And as I said earlier, we see that craving is suffering. Craving is not pleasant. Craving is not conducive to well-being in the moment. Our minds have fooled us to thinking craving will be conducive to well-being some moments from now in the future. But we are willing, with that belief, to abandon feeling, having well-being in this moment for the hope of some possible well-being in the future. Well, there's more in my notes, but I want to stop here and just give a few minutes for comments or questions. And this is the topic for the next few weeks, so we'll keep coming at it from different directions and unpacking it in different ways. So, yeah, any comments or questions? And you're welcome to just unmute yourselves if you'd like to ask a question. Or if you'd like to type something in the chat box, that's okay too. Yeah, Ali.
Thank you, Andrea. It's very interesting, contemplative subject. Actually, I'll share something about like this morning. I was walking, and then so I noticed the arousal, my aversion towards something that happened earlier in the morning. In my walk, it was a guy that was not wearing a mask. He was like close to me. So this arised in my mind. Luckily, as you were mentioning, wise mindfulness, like 10 minutes later, it was present. So I saw that.
And so you had an aversion later? So you...
Yes, yes. Yeah, okay. My mind was looping to 10 minutes earlier. For some reason,
like the image of the person rose.
Yeah, absolutely.
In right.
Uh-huh. Yes, yes. The image of the person came in and my mind gave it to me. So I was able to replace it with for lack of my own creativity, like with a white piece of paper. And I just stayed with the white piece of paper and kind of like tried to put that in there instead. I don't know if we can want to. What happened? I said, good. I was happy that I did something else rather than like my usual lack of mindfulness and just looping on that and staying tight and uptight that why did this happen for, and then, the looping, the samsara will go on. What happened this morning when I put the white piece of paper there on that memory card that came up that I saw, I was lucky enough to see it. So that was my fortunate part. For some conditionality reason, I was able to be present at that time. I practiced with it later in the afternoon today, also for a couple other. It gave me some sort of an agency, some sort of an happiness and all of that. But I just want to hear your comments on that, just to create something else when something comes up. If I'm mindful, if I'm just going to replace it with something else.
This is one of the tools that the Buddha does suggest for when something unhelpful arises, to replace it with something more wholesome. And neutrality is more wholesome than the unwholesome in that case. It's just something like the white piece of paper that is more wholesome. And so that is a tool that the Buddha suggests that can be useful.
Where in the teachings is that? I haven't seen that one.
I think it's in Majjhima Nikaya number 19.
Wow. I remember the numbers.
It's either 19 or 20. It's one of those two. Oh. I think it's 19.
That's okay, Andrea. Thank you.
It's called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. The sutta is called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. And it lists five tools.
Wow.
Got five of them in there.
I have never.
and basically, I like to point to those as useful. If it feels like being aware of the response, so you notice the thought, and you notice the kind of aversion to the thought. Mm-hmm. Another possibility to play with there would be to recognize, well, okay, there is aversion here. What is that like? And can you be with the aversion without getting hooked into the story? So it's essentially, it's like you've got the thought, and then there's the response to the thought, the aversion. And, so it's like take the attention out of the thought, which you could do by kind of envisioning putting a blank paper there. But then it may not mean that the aversion disappears immediately. So really useful to be able to hold that, to be curious about what is that experience. Sometimes that exploration, being with the aversion, this is what it feels like to be with aversion. For me, early on in my practice, that was not so easy. And I would find myself just immediately looped back into the story. So that's when it's useful to start using some of those tools. If you find that the mind can't really practice with what's here in the moment.
Mm-hmm. So, what was it called again? I'm sorry,
the removal of distracting thoughts.
Thank you.